Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley welcoming you to a new episode of Criterion Reflections. Our subject today is Jacques Tati's Traffic, released in April of 1971. I'm joined by Derek J. Power and also by Arik Devens. Unfortunately, I couldn't get them both together at the same time. Derek and I were able to connect a few nights ago, and so I think we had a solid conversation about this film. Very amusing, perhaps a little bit of a step down from Playtime, and we kind of debate as to where Traffic ranks among the great films of Jacques Tati, who didn't make a lot of features, but they were all pretty special in their own way. At the end of this episode, at the end of the conversation between myself and Derek, I'm going to attach a little epilogue recorded by Arik Devens. Familiar to many of you, he's been on this podcast before, also a pretty regular contributor to the Criterion Cast website, and the author of the Cinema Gadfly blog. He was originally lined up to join us, but various obstacles arose that made it impossible for him to be part of that particular discussion. So I encouraged Arik to give us a little tidbit of his thoughts on Traffic, and he did so very, very nicely. And so before you click to the next thing in your podcasting queue after Derek and I wrap up our conversation, please stay tuned. There will be a little transitional music, and then Arik will cap it off with his own reflections on Jacques Tati's Traffic. So listen in and enjoy. Okay, so I'm here with Derek J. Power. Derek, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to speak again.
Yeah, it's probably been, a few months. I think this is the first time you've been on in the season 371, but you did some of the shorts at the end of 1970 with me.
Yep.
Let's just catch up with you. Tell us what's going on. I know you've got you're continuing the Vaporwave music thing. You got a little bit of an album project going. Tell listeners about that.
Let's see. I'm trying to get my first album, Reincarnated Resurrection, onto vinyl, and I'm doing this through Q-Rates, which is a way of making your own vinyl releases. And one of the ways that you can make that happen is that if you set up a crowdfund situation. So when you reserve a copy, it's like pre-ordering, but you're also helping to fund the project so that it can get on their way. So by the time this goes up, it will be about a month left in the campaign. So you can still, if you go on to Q-Rates.com, look for Reincarnated Resurrection, which is actually now a featured project on the site, which is good. And just reserve a copy for $25, and then at the end of the campaign, then we make the record, and then it's shipped out directly from them.
All right, well, sign me up. I will pledge my support right here and now, so you can count on that. Definitely want to encourage you in your project, seeing this vision through, which I guess in some very oblique way kind of connects with what we're going to be talking about tonight with Jacques Tati's Traffic, or is it Traffic? I don't know how to pronounce it. I mean, Traffic would have a Q-U-E at the end, but because it's only got the one F, I feel like I can't pronounce it just Traffic. What do you think?
I've heard it said as Traffic. So.
Okay, so we'll just do Traffic.
We're good.
Okay. Not to be confused with a Steven Soderbergh film of approximately 30 years later.
Right.
About drug running and all the nefarious deeds that happen.
Yep, gritty
smuggling
realism.
Smuggling our narcotics across the border and all of that. This is just about people driving cars and looking out the window.
Yep. So, different continent, too.
Yeah, for sure. Different. Yeah, a whole different place and time. Now, when we first were putting this episode together, we had a few different guests involved, but it's kind of whittled down to the bare minimum, just me and Derek. And, this is kind of an odd movie. Even as I've been contemplating what I'm going to say about this, it's one of those movies that seems to me that it's really best just kind of watch an experience on its own. But, as a podcast, we got to talk about all of them. Let's just start by talking about Jacques Tati. Maybe we can kind of get the big picture in here first, at least for a little intro. Maybe you can tell me, Derek, why did you want to get into this podcast? What drew you to this particular episode?
Well, in general, what I like about participating in these reflections is that it gives me an excuse to revisit what I already have on my shelf. So, of course, I have the complete Jacques Tati set. And this has been the first time that I've gone through any of the materials since I first got the set in late 2014. And so just, yeah, just to like revisit some titles and so forth. And, you know, just kind of see what I thought of them back then and compared to how I think about them now.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's a pretty good entry point. You know, Traffic is kind of outside the core canon, if you will, of Jacques Tati, which I think is basically the three masterpieces, popular favorites, higher shelf items, which, you know, Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, Mon Oncle or My Uncle, and Playtime. I think those are the three that are the clear standouts that get the whole cult following going. And you can go back to his earliest film, Jour de Fête, and of course there's the short films, and Traffic, which are kind of the add-ons. They're kind of the appendices of Tati's career. And there is that little subsect out there that says, oh no, Traffic is a full-fledged masterpiece. It's right up there, you know, with the best of them, if you get on this wavelength. And I don't know, I mean, do we need to have that debate there?
I think it's unfair to relegate Traffic as a subset. I mean, I know it makes sense because it to think that way because it follows Playtime and it is such a grand vision, and it certainly was the embodiment of everything that Tati was trying to achieve at that point. And so it's like, how do you follow up that film? It's kind of like, you know, following up Lord of the Rings, you know, how do you do that? But at the same time, I think Traffic is just as accomplished as certainly those three. In fact, in a way, it reminds me the most of Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, in that whereas Mon Oncle and Playtime were constructed realities to give a sort of exaggeration, here it's like Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, it's using just the natural environment to play up the comedy. And in the case of Traffic, it's using a car show and the highways of France and Belgium and the Netherlands to do it. So he didn't have to do anything more to it to bring up the comedy, you know, unlike Mon Oncle or Playtime, where in Playtime he had to basically construct a couple of blocks of a kind of Le Corbusier designed Paris. He didn't have to do anything like that.
No, he's kind of getting Hulot into the then natural world, which was a world of freeways and travel and international borders and commerce. There is a progression. I mean, if you go back to the earliest films, Jour de Fête and the mailman training school or whatever that's called in French. I mean, you know, the images of Jacques Tati on a bicycle and now here he is in a vehicle and he, of course, he's older here. There's a very deliberate playing up of the role that Monsieur Hulot plays in this film. In fact, his name is above the title credits. Mr. Hulot, Mr. Hulot is featured right there in the opening screens, which is also kind of interesting because the French convention would be M. Hulot. So there's almost a bit of a commercial concession in that respect, and that I think is fairly well known by anybody who's studied Tati, that he really didn't want to perpetuate the character of Monsieur Hulot. I mean, that was really supposed to just be a one-off for Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, but the character was so beloved and so successful that he was pretty much commanded, or for commercial possibilities, really persuaded that you got to keep this character in there. And Playtime was in one of the many dimensions that he pursued in that film, was to downplay Monsieur Hulot. And you had decoys and stand-ins and fake-outs, you know, tricking the audience. And he really very conscientiously wanted to make this a comedy about everybody, about every man, every woman, in their own place in this, you know, cosmic social drama and comedy that's going on. But, you know, the pressures, if you will, of winning a mass audience and then recouping some of the money that was lost when Playtime went so drastically over budget,
right,
kind of compelled him to play the conventional hand.
Yeah.
And yet, I really get the feeling from this film that Tati would have been happily, you know, off camera more than he even was in this film, where he's very much a kind of marginal character, but he's there. He's off there often enough, but it's not like a Chaplin or a Keaton or other type of great film comedians where the focus is so entirely... Harold Lloyd, of course, right, where they are such a compelling center of attraction. He really does kind of fade away in this film. This is the last appearance of Monsieur Hulot, and I don't think we exactly miss him. He's just an observer, and that's a very appropriate place for him to sort of step in and then step out and let us reflect on what's going on here.
I would agree to that to some extent, except I think at the same... I mean, yeah, I'm sure, yeah, you're right about with Tati and his view of that character, but... At the same time, I think it does sort of, he does sort of serve as a kind of catalyst for everything else. You know, he's mm-hmm. sort of our guide. You know, much like the Tramp for Chaplin or Harold Lloyd's, you know, Man with the Glasses, the kind of everyman character. And Hulot was even kind of designed sort of to be, you know, not a character in his own right, but just more of a vehicle to do all of these comedic motions, which in of itself was based on highly astute and a very, I think, even respectful observation of just everyday life, of just what people do. I mean, like what he, when he talked about in Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, when he talked about how people don't really go, like when they're on vacation, they're not really on vacation. They're doing something else entirely besides mm-hmm. being leisurely. And he was just pointing that out. And then in Mon Oncle, it's the you know, the town turned bigger town due to bigger company being headquartered there, and then of course Playtime being the new urban development, and then Traffic, it's just how people just as he rightly observed, is when you get into your car, your whole personality changes as soon as you get in one.
Yeah, it's this kind of human-machine synthesis, really, although we don't think of it as so advanced, but it really is. And he is a bit of the old school, where, you know, the person without the mechanical apparatus is who they are. And the car, like you say, does really change our expression, our interaction, our role in society.
I don't know if he had that. I mean, he certainly made that point, but I don't think he was in there to like make a polemic about, you know, this is mm-hmm. you know, this is bad or anything, but this is definitely something he's noticed, and I think he wanted to certainly play that up and to kind of point that out and see, you know, this is kind of what you do to yourselves when you get into a car, and whether it's, you know, stopping at a gas station, and, you know, after you get you filled up, you get this free historical bust.
this big plaster thing. What are you going to do with that?
How aesthetic.
But, you know, and as a kid of that era, I remember going to the Sinclair stations and the Essos and, you know, the Marathon and Texaco, all the state gas stations of those era, and getting those free goodies. It was like toys at the bottom of the cereal box.
I actually had my own little toy experience. I remember, I might have been 10 or so, but Shell gas stations had this had these presidential coins that
Remember those. I had a collection. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I actually went out of my way, so I had to I reminded my mom to like go to a Shell station to like to collect all 8 of these presidential coins. So.
Yeah, was that like bicentennial era or something like that, or when was that?
No, I think they just had it offered, and then I always had the collection mindset, which is why which is why I lean so well to Criterion.
Sure, you put a number on it, and you got to get them all.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what is this movie about. I mean, it really is the narrative arc is very rudimentary. You've basically got a prototype car that's been manufactured for a car show mm-hmm. in France. It's got to get up to Amsterdam, And there's a series of problems that ensue along the way. That's really it. And even when it gets there, it's anticlimactic. And then the final scenes are just a complete kind of dissipation into whatever. Just people wandering and strolling through this massive traffic jam / parking lot with their umbrellas in the rain. And
exactly.
That's it.
it's kind of the anti-road trip movie in a way. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a great kind of, you know, niche to put it in, because this is an era of great road movies. I mean, we've got Two-Lane Blacktop that'll be coming up later this season, I believe, mm-hmm. and Vanishing Point, and
yep.
all kinds of, you know, muscle car extravaganzas. This is really just kind of, it's got that same obsession with the automobile and the culture growing up around it. And it's definitely coming from more of a Eurocentric point than the great American open road. Even you could even say an outgrowth of Easy Rider, even though it's more of a motorcycle aesthetic. This is obviously a little bit more compact, a little bit more constrained, a little bit more Euro. But it's a very amusing little slice of life and an analysis of a little society.
Yep, and especially it's still kind of eerily relevant even today. Just if you live in a major metropolitan area. I mean, like for me, I'm outside of Boston, and so mm-hmm. like seeing some of those scenes, like the cars breaking down, and the scenes at the end with the windshield wipers kind of having mirroring the personality of the drivers. You know, I wish it was that fun, but just little touches like that. It's like, yeah, we're still dealing with this, you know, even after all these years, you know.
Yeah, and I think in this era of automotive manufacturing, you did have a lot more kind of quirky personality in your vehicles. I mean, not that you can't get a car today that has that own kind of individual aesthetic and style to it that says, hey, check me out. But it really feels like in the 60s, early 70s, of course the 50s have some pretty incredible models of cars, and really the whole history of automobiles from the 20s on up into the 70s really are quite a fascinating study if you just wanted to look at technology as an extension of the ego. it's still there today, but I feel like the quirkiness and the oddity of it all is really played up quite a bit. I mean, some of these little models and buggies and just the way they would use the hydraulics and the gadgets. Of course, the camping car is a piece in all of itself. But even the ordinary vehicles, just the little sedans and everyday stuff, there was a real sort of a creative, expressive dimension that with aerodynamics and fuel efficiency and safety standards nowadays, you just don't have that creative freedom to just kind of do your own whimsical thing in putting a vehicle on the road.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine it's kind of funny like you mentioned about the features in cars, because like nowadays you have nav systems and cameras that allow you to see more of the rear as you're backing up, and little warning lights to let you know if you're drifting off the road or if there's something in your blind spot and all this stuff. I mean, it's all very utilitarian, but then you look at that camping car
and
you have a way to grill your steak in front of the car or you hook up some pipes and you can have a shower from the rear. And
right, you got an electric razor if you got a shave on the go.
in the horn, yeah.
In the horn, right.
Yeah, you have to flip a little switch your horn changes into electric shaver. And it even comes with its own TV set.
yeah. And of course, there's an interesting little sequencing going on here as they're, basically there's kind of a progressive exploration of the moon landing, which again is a very specific place and time. And, you know, I've got those kind of nostalgic childhood memories of watching Apollo landings as they were going on. And from the beginning to the end of the film, there's just these little interludes where characters will plant themselves in front of a TV screen at various points in time. And you've got the blast off, you've got the orbiting of the moon, the approach to the lunar surface, then you've got a landing, and you've even got some mechanics doing their own little slow-mo version of a moonwalk, which was pretty
I was kind of wondering about that, like, if it's supposed to put it in that specific time, like if we're supposed to believe this is July 20, 1969, or if it was just something
one of the moon landings, you know. Yeah, maybe it was the first one, maybe it was the second or the third. I would imagine probably 69 is when Tati was making this film. He was not a guy who just kind of slapped these things out pretty obviously.
Well, it came out in 71, so it would have been, 14 would have happened by that point, I believe.
And maybe even by the time it was released, he realized this wasn't the original first moon landing, but they were happening every several months for a while. You know, it was kind of I remember even as a kid thinking, oh, another moon landing. Yeah, big deal. Whoop-de-doo. Well, I'd be feeling pretty differently about that today if that was the case, but, you know, familiarity and all that. But it does kind of put us in this time frame of travel, of exploration, of you know, new frontiers, and yet the mundane, the ordinary is all around us, you know, manufacturing and you know, just doing the job. I mean, there's humorous bits about the labor force doing their thing, the painters and the assembly line workers, the cops kind of, you know, just going about their everyday business. So that observational humor of just humans being human and quirky and weird is all running through this film.
Oh yeah, definitely.
We talked about maybe it's not fair to compare Traffic to these other masterpieces, but what do you think? I mean, what do you think is the kind of the resonating impact or lasting attraction of this film? Is this one that just that TT obsessive completist could enjoy? Is this one that you just would put on for sort of casual entertainment for its own sake? What are your thoughts?
Certainly, if you like Tati, I mean, it's a way to complete it. But I think, you know, my first exposure to Tati was Monsieur Hulot's Holiday. Mm-hmm. But I would say Traffic is a good intro into that world. Like, certainly his humor and what he was interested in and what he enjoys about entertainment, and as well as serving as a kind of nice little commentary jab on life and everything. It's certainly a good place to start.
I like the colorfulness of it. You know, that is interesting. I mean, even Playtime has this kind of steely, greenish, kind of metallic edge to it.
And that was purposefully so.
Oh, of course, right. All right. And in fact, the two different Blu-rays that I own, you sort of see a different kind of use of filters in both transfers. So there's some interesting comparisons as to how severe Tati's look is in that film. This here does have a warmth to it, and it doesn't have maybe quite the the strenuous kind of edge. I mean, Playtime, I love that film. I mean, it's probably a top 10 masterpiece of great cinema, but there's a certain intensity to it that is like, okay, you almost got to kind of gird yourself for it. This is a little bit lower stakes, a little bit easier access, if you will. It's certainly not as long, so you can kind of pop it in. It's a quick hour and a half, and as I've been kind of revisiting it and kind of just living with it in my imagination, I think it has definitely grown in my estimation, because it is kind of an expansion on Tati's world that I'm definitely glad that we have, and that I would not want to do without. Having said that, I mean, there are times where it feels like it's a bit of work to hang in there with it, because I mean, what did you think about the way the story flows? I mean, there's a risk of losing the audience that I think Tati has here, that if you're not really attentive and playing along with it, it's just like, what is going on? What is this all about? And I guess that's maybe the critique of the film, is it kind of, you know, flounders is kind of a harsh word, but I can see where it just wouldn't work for some viewers, or if I'm not in the right mood to stick with it, maybe even for me.
I think this is the first time where he had to deal with parallel storylines, because in the films prior to it, it's pretty, it's pretty central as far as location. I mean, in Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, it's the resort. Even Joe de Fed, it's just this little village.
Mm-hmm.
And in Mon Oncle, it's the same thing, a village. And then Playtime, it's the city. But here, you're actually going across three countries. You know, this is France, Belgium, and the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And you also and the caravan that goes from Altra in France, there's three different cars that make the journey. So,
and they're always intersecting with each other in really weird ways. Like, and it's like, if you're just kind of just sort of sitting back watching, it's like, how did they just find each other? What is that? What's going on here?
Yeah,
it's very fluky and coincidental. And I think that's part of the humor. But again, if you're not like tracking with it, it's just like, how did that just happen?
Right. And they all have different situations, like the truck that carries the camping car, you know, it has certain jokes, and then the little sports car with public relations driving through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the little when yellow I heard that jalopy name, type thing, right?
Yeah, when I heard that name, it made me think immediately of Moonrise Kingdom with social services. you're not nice, a person, yes, with a name. You're just a job title.
I'm a function, yes. So. Yeah. And
I'm sure that was intentional on his part too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. The bureaucracy, the segmentation of and specialization of modern society, you know, rather than well-rounded people or individuals, we are roles. You know, we inhabit a certain duty in society, and that's who we are.
And not only having a specific role, but having a coordinated wardrobe.
Oh yeah. yeah, exactly. Yeah, she every scene there's like some new twist. I mean, it's all of a piece, it's all of a character. She's very vibrant and maybe even a little bit of one of the sexiest female characters in all of Tati's films.
Yeah.
Was that a concession? I don't know, or just kind of an acknowledgement that this is modernity, you know, and so, you know, people have a little bit more of that out front personality.
It's a nice bonus.
Yeah, for sure. and she is. Yeah, she lends a fun vibrancy. I mean, Tati himself is getting a little older. He's a little bit more grandfatherly in some respects in this film. So it's nice to have a little bit of that youthful infusion. And speaking of youthful infusions, what about the hippie element? That's interesting, because you do have, probably for the only time, I'd have to think back on Playtime, but this seems to be Tati's real engagement with the, you know, full blown counterculture. I mean, it's not, you know,
we've talked about Tati being the perpetual observer. I mean, mm-hmm. There's no doubt that he was observing his time, and it was always commenting on his time. So I'm not surprised that element is in there. In fact, going back to Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, when he re-released it in 1978, he included a few shots that were commentaries on Jaws, which is,
sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, talk about ultra revisionism right there. You know, to take a film that was in the 1950s and interject with something that happened in, you know, 20 years later.
But I think he was also recognizing that Jaws was a game changer even for cinema. It wasn't just the fad of sharks in the water, but it was, right, just what Jaws represented for the whole movie culture. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think this is just a continuation of just his his observation of like what's going on. You know, like this is what's happening right now in Europe, and this is what you see, and so it's just a part of that. I mean, if Tati were around, or someone like Tati were around now, then you would clearly have, hipsters or whatever.
Yeah. And cell phones
countercultural thing you have in all there. That. So.
I mean, but it was quite, a little eye-popping moment. It was probably the second or third time I watched the film there. In that scene where there's a bunch of people in the police station after the truck has been pulled over, there's a hippie. He's like ready to pass a joint to the bride. It's like, oh, yeah. Well, how about that?
Yeah. The eloping couple. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And this is one of the numerous bounties of these films, is that, there's so much intelligence, there's so much care and thought put into these scenes that even little throwaway moments that you might have just missed, you turned away or you were focused on some other detail. Of course, Playtime is very famous for that, for, sometimes 3, 4, 5, 6 different things happening in different sectors of the screen.
Oh, yeah.
And you turn your eye this way or that, and you're going to almost have a different experience from moment to moment. Trafic has also got a lot of that in it, maybe not quite as abundantly loaded, but it's still really marvelous just to watch all the little things, the little elements of Tati's world that play themselves out in front of us, and keep these films completely rewatchable.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's definitely a lot to glean, and I think it's one of those things where like it depends on what mood you are or what you're looking for. I mean, some things that you may. One time you watch it, you may think, oh, this is kind of inconsequential, or this doesn't really do it for me. But then the next time you see it, it's like, oh, this is a lot more funny than it was the last time. So I think it's that approach of, there's something for everybody. And just Tati always strikes me as somebody that was always aiming to please. And it's just, you never know. As long as it's funny and interesting, it will reach somebody. Somebody will get something out of it. So, you don't have to enjoy every single minute of it, but if you enjoyed at least one thing, then he's done his job for as far as he's concerned.
Yeah, yeah, and I think there's there's definitely value in coming back. I mean, even in some of my rewatches over the past week or so, it's like, oh man, what am I going to say about this? because it's just kind of there spinning out on the screen. We've already touched on some of the cool moments, but let's just kind of dissect some of the set pieces here. What did you think about the big car crash? The big orchestrated.
my first reaction was, John Landis would eventually do this better.
Okay. Sure, bigger budgets, higher, better,
more cars, just more spectacular crashes.
Right.
But then there's these little moves that are just kind of they're kind of balletic a bit. Mm-hmm. Like there's that one car that is just riding on its front axle, and its rear is high up on the ground. Mm-hmm, and it's just sliding along. It's like, oh, this is kind of weird.
It's kind of a Herbie the Love Bug, if you remember those Disney movies. I mean, that was kind of a cool little flashback of humor for me, at least.
Well, speaking of Mickey Mousing, then there's the beetle that gets off the road, and its front trunk is
kind
flapping.
Of barking.
But the sound is a donkey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a nice little it's a nice little visual aural play.
Right, right. And it felt like Tati was having some fun with mechanics and logistics and just kind of this choreography of metal and machine.
It's what if cars were to do pantomime.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what that is. And it's like, okay, that's a neat little set piece.
Yeah, and then there's this little moment of reprieve at the end of it all. After all this chaos, now it's everybody just kind of
yeah, just stretching, like, oh, okay.
What just happened here? where am I? How did I get here?
Well, it's a little breather because you know, because like for before that, you know, you're always on the road. Everybody's like, oh, we gotta finish this by this time. We gotta hurry up. We gotta get this on the road in the morning. Just quick. But here, you know, after this, this sort of explosion, if you will, mm-hmm. and everyone's like, okay, this has happened, and all right, we can kind of dust ourselves off and stretch and kind of get ourselves in order, and then we get back onto the rat race.
yeah. And he didn't save this big pileup for the end. You know, this isn't like the big culmination of it all where everything just kind of erupts into, you know, chaos and carnage and
right.
explosions and all that. It's a very, you know, it's a midpoint of the film, and then we're going to go on to other things. There's almost like sort of a crescendo and then a slow, gradual fade as the film kind of draws to its own conclusion on its own terms in a much more, you know, amiable fashion.
Yeah, if you want intense and bloody and confusing, just stick with J.G. Ballard.
Sure, or Godard's Weekend, you know, great French car pileup, if you want to do it that way. Yeah. Another element, I posted a link on my personal Facebook page. Maybe I'll put a link in the show notes here. Bert Hanstra is a name that is flashed briefly in the credits, and he's actually, I think, kind of like a co-screenwriter or maybe a directorial assistant of some sort. Bert Hanstra was a man, a Dutch filmmaker who did a film called Zoo. I don't know if you happen to see that on my timeline or not, Derek. But,
no, I haven't.
It's like a 10-12 minute sort of an observational humor piece that was made in the early 1960s about people, Dutch people in this case, because I think it was filmed at the Amsterdam Zoo. People looking at animals and animals looking back at the people.
Okay.
And it's a really beautiful little piece because it again, it has that kind of little step outside of the, you know, conventional mainstream and says, you know, who's watching what and what's going on here? It's black and white. He does that same kind of juxtaposition. You talked about the windshield wipers reflecting the personality of the of the individuals behind the wheel of those cars, or the passengers in some cases. This is the same thing where the people looking at the animals and the animals looking back at them almost, you know, he edits it to kind of share some of the common characteristics, whether it's animals eating or people eating or, you know, kind of scratching or hugging or snuggling. You know, we're all just kind of critters staring at each other is kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Hanstra was actually the guy who filmed the nose picking sequence.
I was going to point that out.
Yeah. And so Hanstra and Tati actually kind of collaborated on that. So what did you think of those little moments there?
Well, again, it's, you know, the other thing that I, well, the thing, my little homework was that I went and saw the, one of the features on the set, which was, the French aired, TV program, In the Footsteps of Jacques Tati.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's where I keep coming back to the whole thing about Tati being the observer of human behavior. So seeing that and going back to like the nose picking scene is like, yeah, this is kind of what people do when you have when you have a moment and you know, you just got to get it out there. And actually then that makes me think of a Seinfeld episode where that was that whole thing where some, you know, his Jerry's girlfriend observed him picking his nose and so it's like, no, that my finger wasn't on there, and he had to like deny that and everything.
I was flicking. Yeah, right.
I was flicking. So times hardly do change.
Well, humans are human, you know. I mean, the basic biology really hasn't altered. But yeah, you do think of Tati in the modern era, and you know, cell phones and the distractions of driving nowadays with all the screens and with all the stimulus that we're,
yeah, you know,
so accustomed to
now,
and so dependent on. Yeah.
Yeah, if this were remade now, that's what you would be seeing, is like everybody like looking down and, you know, sending a quick text message before they have to drive on or something.
Yeah, yeah, it's just the incessant pace of life. Any other moments or bits that you want to kind of throw out there as especially worthy of attention discussion?
Well, the first moment that I noticed where I just laughed was in the beginning, where you're at the car show and they're setting up the they're setting up the booths for everybody. So you got this convention space that's just completely empty, but you have people putting lines in to indicate, you know, where the exhibitions are going to be, and they set up these little like ankle high strings on it.
So you have to step
over it. So you have these lawn shots of people just kind of walking over these wires in this big empty space.
Yeah. And, yeah. This airport hangar basically, and all these high stepping, sort of a Monty Python.
Exactly.
Ministry of Funny
I immediately
Walks, right?
thought of Ministry of Silly Walks when I saw that. Uh-huh. And again, this was 1971, and Flying Circus was being aired over at the BBC at that time.
Yeah, yeah, but it was just kind of a funny acknowledgement of physical awkwardness in these open spaces, all these officious men kind of getting their big events set up, and, you know, just a little goofiness along the way. Very, very charming, obviously, Tati must have just spent a lot of time just watching humanity do its thing and taking notes or filing it away mentally, however he came up with these pieces. And, yeah, just creating a very memorable experience of watching this world unfold in front of itself.
Indeed.
All right. Well, you know, maybe we don't need to elaborate too much longer here. This is, you know... You've talked about the set, you know, you've watched these films, you know, that this was a good revisit for you overall.
Oh yeah, definitely. And, yeah, I would say give Traffic a spin, as they say. You know, you know, on the one hand, again, I could see why people would say, oh, this is not as great as Playtime, but then again, how can you top that film? But it has all the hallmarks of Tati's, certainly his humor and what he was known for, and it's all there. It's just now you have a different premise, you know, instead of a single place, now it's the open road, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. There's kind of a bigger world that he's a part of, and yet at the same time, I think his essential character is coming through. He's not really a mocker of humanity. He's got kind of a compassionate outlook.
Oh yeah.
But kind of bemused at our pettiness and our easily distracted nature. And also just the common working class folk of the world. So,
yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, all right, Derek. Well, thanks. And any other final wrap up comments, or do you think we've said our piece?
Yeah, I think we've covered a lot of ground.
All right. Excellent. Okay. Well, we are going to be getting on to episode number 50 very soon. Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song is coming up to mark the half century mark here at Criterion Reflection. So thank you very much for your input tonight, Derek. It's great connecting with you. And I do want to encourage listeners to give Reincarnated Resurrection a listen and maybe some support. So thanks for putting the plug in for that. I wish you all the best with this project and hope it comes to fruition.
Thank you, David, and travel well.
All right. Keep on rolling.
So I'm recording my thoughts on the Jacques Tati film Traffic because I was unfortunately unable to join the podcast recording. And so I'm mostly just going to be reading what I wrote on my Cinema Gadfly blog back in November of 2017. I start out with a sort of top level thought on every film that I review. And so this time I said, I love this film so much. It's just so perfectly goofy with so many expertly arranged moments. The scene where M. Hulot demonstrates the features of his camping car are the highlight, but really the whole thing is so great. It's exceedingly difficult to explain to anyone what exactly makes the film of Jacques Tati so funny. They either get them or they don't. And they need to watch one to find out. Even then, they need to be unusually patient as the humor develops in its own time. Once you get it, the entire thing becomes so wonderfully absurd. Everything begins to make sense, like pieces in an increasingly complex puzzle. Slowly, sometimes shockingly slowly, it all comes together beautifully. I've seen this film called His Weakest, and while I understand where those people are coming from, it seems a bit silly to me. What's the point of rating masterpieces? Do I think this film is as good as Playtime? No, I guess not. But that's hardly a fair bar to hold anything up to. So it's not as good as one of the greatest films of all time. Cool. Tati didn't make all that many films, and they are all so perfect that I guess it's natural that we become nitpicky. Sustained greatness gets taken for granted eventually. Perhaps the issue is that this film is more conventional than its predecessor. It would be hard for it to be less conventional and still resemble anything like a coherent narrative, but here we have something straightforward, at least on the surface. We have three people trying to get a new car to a car show traveling from Paris to Amsterdam. But of course, it's not that simple. The destination isn't what matters. The journey isn't even really what matters. They are almost never actually in motion. Instead, it's all the insanity that surrounds it. Tati was a master of finding the ridiculousness in everything. Here it's in our behavior while driving, fertile territory for his wisdom. People seem to utterly change when they're behind the wheel of an automobile, and not always in predictable fashion based on their non-car personality. The film explores the theme so well, all while remaining light and goofy. It's so wonderful, and I'm so happy I have these films to watch whenever I want. So yeah, just a little quick note from me on how I feel about this film. It's honestly one of my favorites. I think I may have even seen it before I saw Playtime. I'm not sure about that, but it was definitely one of the first Tatis I saw. And I just adore it. I think it's hilarious. I think the colors are amazing. The plot works super well. Everything about it is just wonderful. It honestly just makes me sad that he didn't really do that much after this, a couple TV things, but this is kind of the end of his film output. And, you know, I guess if all we have are these films, then I'll just savor each one. But I absolutely love this movie, and I highly recommend that anyone who enjoys silent comedy or mostly silent comedy or, you know, physical comedy, like, to me, Tati is part of that generation of French comedians that really seem like they're continuing the work of Lloyd and Chaplin and Keaton. You know, they just are so wonderfully physical in their comedy and so all approachable and just for everyone. I just think everyone will find something in this film to enjoy, and I love it. So, thanks.
Say, no matter what they do, gonna end up in the middle of that rock and roll stew, and I'll be